Here in the United States, food costs 5.5% of our disposable income. Not bad. Think about it. Elsewhere in the world, food costs up to 45.6% of disposable income. That's not good. Why is food so cheap here in the United States of America?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, thank you, Will Strickland. Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1099th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Fremantle who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Strubia on the boards. Jason.
It's my pleasure.
Are you having any luck finding our guest?
I think so.
Working it through good. Indeed. Quick question for you, Jason.
Yes.
While you're between telephone and headset there.
Sure.
Why do you think we have such cheap food here in the United States?
I think it might have to do with quality of ingredients.
Quality of ingredients.
Indeed.
Well, let's give that a thought as we go through the show today, folks. When writing Metro Farm, I went looking for the reason big farms beat little farms in the competition for consumer dollars. That's a no-brainer, I was told. It's the economies of scale. And what are those economies of scale, I asked. Well, came the reply, suppose you have a 1 acre farm and I have a 1,000 acre farm. One day we both go downtown and buy a $10,000 tractor. Now, that tractor is going to cost you $10,000 per acre, but it's only going to cost me $10 per acre. Now, which one of us do you think is going to grow the cheapest food? These economies of scale come into play every time a dollar is spent on the cost of doing business. The more size you have, the less cost per size it's going to be. But there is one cost of doing business where economies of scale are particularly effective. A couple of years ago, I received a phone call from an attorney specializing in ag-related legal issues. "Did you receive the letter?" he said. "Now, what letter?" I asked. "The one that said, if local agriculture is taking a bite out of your profits, join us in Washington, D.C. Well, let's see. If I have a 1 acre farm and he has a 1,000 acre farm, and one day we decide to buy a congressperson a $10,000 flight to a golf game in Tahiti, that flight will cost me $10,000 per acre, but it will only cost him $10 per acre. Guess who is flying whom to Tahiti?" And so after due consideration, which means like 1,000 editions of the Food Chain Radio program, I came up with Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, which is cheap food isn't. I believe food is made cheap by taking the food out of it and by subsidizing the true costs of its production. Thus, the cheap food promised is really the expensive food delivered. And that leads me to your question of the day, which is, who should pay the true costs of cheap food? Should it be consumers or should it be taxpayers? Well, today we've got two warriors to help us work this out. Well, the first warrior with us today is Professor Marion Nessel, professor of nutrition at the New York University and author of Sugar Politics. Marion, welcome to the Food Chain.
Oh, glad to be here.
Glad to have you aboard. I was wondering if you got caught in a New York City traffic jam or something there for a moment, but we got you through.
I think you called the wrong number was what happened.
Okay. That would be an accident that happens occasionally. Well, it's been a while since we last spoke, and back in Food Chain number 936, so a while ago, and we were talking about eating and drinking and voting, which has a lot to do with our food and selection of our food. And now we're back talking about cheap food. And as the author of Soda Politics, it seems as though you are taking on Big Soda and winning. But why are you taking on Big Soda? Why would you want to go to war with Coke and Pepsi?
Well, I don't like putting it in war terms.
Oh, okay.
This is a public health issue. Sugar sweetened beverages have sugars and water and nothing else of nutritional value, and the amount of sugar that's in them is really quite amazing. People don't have any idea that there are 10 teaspoons of sugar in a 12-ounce soft drink. And sodas are half of the sugar in American diets. Americans consume about twice the amount of sugar that's recommended. So if you want to cut down on your sugar intake, the first thing you do is you cut down on soft drinks. And I was interested in writing about them because what's happening with soft drinks in this country is an example of public health advocacy that has been extraordinarily successful. Sales of sugar-sweetened beverages are down by about 30% since the year 2000.
Wow.
That's a huge percentage.
Well, Marion, let me ask you this. Don't you think,
sure,
you might not think you're at war with the soft drink companies, but I'll bet anything they think you're at war with them.
Well, I can't speak for what they think, but I think they know that obesity has changed the way they have to market their products and they have to develop their products, that the links between consuming sugar-sweetened beverages and obesity and type 2 diabetes are circumstantial, but they're very strongly circumstantial. And the companies are taking responsibility for that and are trying to do everything they can to promote their smaller size products, which I think is a good idea, and also to develop other products that they hope will ultimately be as successful as the ones that are full sugar.
Well, good. Also with us today, folks, we have another warrior who might not want to call herself a warrior. Her name is Katie Kiefer. She's a podcaster with Heritage Radio Network and the author of What's the Matter with Meat? Katie, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks so much for having me, Michael. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. What is the matter with meat? Now, Marion says she's not at war with the sugar companies, but are you not at war with the meat industry?
No, I'm not at all, actually.
Oh, good.
I mean, I'm a card-carrying carnivore myself. I love meat. I've always eaten it. My kid grew up on, I don't have any problem with meat per se. I think there's nothing wrong with eating it. It's delicious. It's nutritious. It's just plain good. But what is not good are the methods in which we produce meat. And, to go to your thesis here about why is food so cheap in this country, the reason are the externalized costs that the meat companies have managed to foist onto taxpayers. And those include the environmental pollution, the level of scale that they work on is often at odds with what is in the best interests of local towns and communities. They've managed to consolidate their empire to the point where in the United States, for example, there are only four major beef-producing meat packers. There are only four or five major chicken-producing. It goes on like that. They've basically forced small farms out of business in order to create that economy of scale you were talking about.
There you go.
And even though Americans are eating less meat than they used to and less beef and pork, more chicken, the rest of the world is fast catching up to and exceeding our own consumption, and that leads to problems around the world that most consumers never give a thought to, and that includes things like the environmental cost, mm-hmm. the fact that we feed these animals corn and soy in great quantities, and to the point where if we continue on this path, we will literally grow no other crop by 2050. There will be no arable land available except for growing crops to feed livestock.
Well, Katie, you brought up a word that I think is really significant to the conversation here, and that is externalized. Marion, I've seen you've been using that word for a long time.
Actually, I try not to.
Okay.
Because nobody understands what it means.
Well, I do.
And I do as well. But I would like you to lay it on the table for the rest of us. What do we mean when we say the costs have been externalized?
Well, let me just, it just means that somebody else is paying for something that you don't necessarily see at the grocery store. You pay for it in some other way. The example that I'm using these days is food marketing. The food and beverage and restaurant industry spend a total of about $30 billion a year in trying to get us to consume their products. And every dollar of that is deductible from their taxes as business expenses. That's an externalized cost. That means that we as taxpayers are paying for the advertising of products that may or may not be good for us.
Wow. And you know, that right there leads us to the question of the day for our audience. Who do you think should pay the true costs of food production? Should it be those who consume the food, or should it be taxpayers? What do you think? 831-479-1080. We are the Food Chain Radio Program with Marion Nessel, Professor of Nutrition, Katie Kiefer, who is the author of What's the Matter with Meat, and you. 831-479-1080. Who do you think should pay?
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro farm it. You can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it, Metro farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro farm it. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, what's eating what is we're eating cheap food. But why are we eating cheap food? Why does that only cost us 5.5% of our disposable income to eat, when other countries it costs up to 45.6%? That's incredible disparity. Why? Marianne, why is our food so cheap?
Well, we have too much of it, for one thing. So there's a supply and demand issue. Starting in the 1970s, federal policies shifted from paying farmers not to grow food to pay farmers to grow as much food as they possibly could. And the number of calories in the food supply increased enormously in response to increased production. We now have about 4,000 calories a day available in the food supply for every man, woman, and little tiny baby in the country. And that's twice what the population needs. So this makes food cheap. It also puts enormous pressure on food companies to try to sell as much food as they possibly can in an extraordinarily competitive environment.
You know, this want to talk to Katie. Toss to Katie. Somebody emailed in and said, you know, you can buy 2,000 calories of junk food or cheap food for $3.52, but 2,000 calories of really nutritious food might cost $36. That make any sense, Katie?
Does it make sense? Well, no. But I think that...
Does it sound real to you? Does that sound like a real number?
That doesn't even sound right to me. But I noted, for example, that you could buy a bag of Doritos for the same amount as you could buy 3 ounces of pork. Ground pork, because pork is cheap, right? Mm-hmm. So you can make those comparisons, but I wouldn't even bother. I mean, I'm not even sure why that person is saying that. You know, the point is to steer the population away from consuming the cheap calories and going towards the more nutritious ones. And yes, if you want to buy your meat from, you know, a farm stand, it will cost you a little more because the farmer is paying for all of those, what we called externalized costs in the earlier segment. You know, that includes managing the waste, the pollution, you know, being able to buy or grow your own grain, you know, things like that that go into raising livestock that on a smaller scale make it much more difficult to gain a profit on them. So, you know, it's more about examining, to me, it's more about examining the system rather than doing a cost analysis on how much one type costs versus the other. It's really like, where is the system breaking down, where we are paying, you know, less for corn chips, where, you know, where corn chips are a better option for a low-income family in terms of getting just calories into a body than buying 3 ounces of pork, which I think we can all agree doesn't go very far mm-hmm. in a family of four. So, you know, Marion is much more knowledgeable about these systems, but, my field of expertise here is, like, why is meat so cheap? Meat is cheap because, A, we grow it. We beat the hell out of the farmers in terms of price. We work with a contract system in two of the three major meat segments. That is essentially an indentured servitude system for farmers. I could go on and on about that. And then they don't pay for any of the costs that are associated with life. They don't pay for the water uses. They don't pay for
cleaning up after the animals. So we're back to these externalized costs, right?
Yeah, this is really the root of the whole problem.
Well, let me toss out an externalized cost that I see that affects both soda pop and meat. And that is the cost that we are incurring for glyphosate herbicide.
Right.
The federal government has been given a research paper by the Monsanto Corporation that says it's safe for us to have more glyphosate in our systems. And so the federal government upped the amount of glyphosate allowed in the human body. Glyphosate is now used to grow almost all the corn and soybeans in the United States. If you look at a usage map of glyphosate in the heartland of America, you'll see it's just covered in glyphosate. And as a consequence, glyphosate is now in 93% of us have glyphosate in our bodies. It's in the water, it's in the rivers, it's in the lakes, it's in vaccines, it's in the milk of nursing mothers, it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. And the federal government says it's okay, and it says it's okay because Monsanto gave them a paper that said it was okay, but the World Health Organization says it's a probable cause of cancer. Now, I don't know who to believe because I don't have enough money to buy any of that science. But if you look at how glyphosate makes possible deferring or externalizing the costs of both soda pop and meat, it's substantial. Or am I wrong?
Oh, yes, absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, they would not be able to grow these bumper harvests of corn and soy without the use of this particular chemical, although it is beginning, one should point out, it is beginning to lose its potency. I mean, herbs weeds are rapidly evolving to resist glyphosate. And so now we have yet another issue in hand, which is that there will be others that will follow the way of being as ubiquitous as glyphosate. I mean, that is definitely an externalized cost. And I think, you know, we have yet to see the public health implications of that. I think Marion can speak to that. But you know, the fact that we are ingesting that much of that one particular chemical certainly should be a red flag to anybody. I mean, I don't drink soda, but I'm sure I've got my share of glyphosate. Marion, have there been studies about public health, public health issues that seem to be arising from the presence of glyphosate in so many humans?
Well, it depends on whose studies you read. This is one of those situations where you can figure out who funded the study by what the result is. And there are very few independently funded studies. Those show that there are increases of pesticides in the blood of people who are around agricultural production areas, absolutely. But it's very difficult to demonstrate specific harm from it. Now, the World Health Organization's Agency for Cancer Research says that glyphosate is a carcinogen, but the industry has produced lots and lots of studies saying that it isn't, and the Environmental Protection Agency seems to be going along with industry on this.
Well, this takes me back to this externalized costs and how industry gets its cost deferred. And this kind of is a classic example right here. The industry with sufficient, like Monsanto we're talking about, has its Roundup Ready crops planted throughout the heartland of America. It has a big, huge, giant, huge, humongous economies of scale. You know, it can afford to buy government, if I could use such a notion, if that's possible.
So you can use that notion.
Okay.
I highly recommend that you do.
Okay. And you know, like I said, if it costs $10,000 to fly a congressperson to Tahiti for a golf game, you know, that would only cost Monsanto like a millionth of a cent per acre to do that. So it's going to do that. And the congressperson is going to be wined and dined on his or her way to Tahiti and land in Tahiti with thinking very highly of the Monsanto Corporation or whatever corporation is doing that gifting. And so how is somebody like the World Health Organization that does not have those economies of scale, how does it compete to have its say? Marianne?
Well, obviously it doesn't, and it can't. It comes out with a report. The report is immediately attacked. And for anybody who doesn't go back and read the original literature, and that includes practically everybody in the world, including me, you know, unless you're a specialist in this area, you end up being confused about what you're supposed to believe about these things. And the part that makes me particularly suspicious about all this is that this comes right out of the tobacco industry playbook. The first thing that you do if you're making a product that's likely to be harmful is you cast doubt on the science that links it to harm. And we've seen that with the tobacco industry, the chemical industry. And I would say there's a fair amount of evidence that, you know, because I've just written a book on soda politics, that soft drink industry funds research to cast doubt on science.
We're going to have to take a quick break. When we get back, I'm going to ask both of you, how does government help big business externalize costs? Right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, I got to wondering, how much would a soft drink cost if the true costs of the soft drink weren't externalized? For example, how much would a soft drink cost if we had to pay the costs of diabetes within that can of soft drinks? Marianne?
Well, I think more directly, the externalized cost is the cleaning up the environment from sugar production. Mm-hmm. The chief ingredient, in fact, the only ingredient in soft drinks is sugar.
But it's sugar, not sugar, sugar, is it?
It's mostly high fructose corn syrup, so it's corn. Corn production gets subsidies of one kind or another. Mm-hmm. It gets support from the Department of Agriculture, so that reduces the cost to the producer. And the company is not responsible for cleaning up the pollution that's caused by sugar production.
Nor is it responsible for the costs.
Another one.
Nor is it responsible for the attendant costs of its glyphosate and Bacillus thuringiensis that's infused in those plants either.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by that, whether these are the cost. The company pays the costs of developing
and putting it on
the insect resistant toxin that's inside, that's in the plants. But that's not, that's a company cost. Mm-hmm. The things that the consumers are paying for as taxpayers are environmental cleanup and whatever the agricultural subsidies and supports are for corn production.
So how much would a can of Coke cost if we had to pay those costs?
I don't have the faintest idea.
Make a wild guess.
I can't. Okay. I just know that in some countries in the world, it's cheaper to buy sugar-sweetened beverages than it is to buy water.
Wow.
Well, that includes the United States, let's face it.
Yeah.
And as pollution continues to encroach on our municipal waterways, such as the case of Des Moines, Iowa, suing those upriver counties for agricultural pollution for growing corn, among other things, you know, those citizens are going to pay more and more for the cost of their water, the water that they drink, they bathe in, they use to cook, et cetera. So there's a perfect example of an externalized cost, Michael. I agree, it's not possible to say that a can of soda should cost $10, if that being the case. But I think that we are all going to see the cost of our basic inputs like water go up largely because of the way we do agriculture in this country by using, you know, intensive pesticides and herbicides such as glyphosate and other products. Those all have an impact on the land, whether it's because of the dead zone in the Mississippi, you know, running down the Mississippi River that culminates in the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, which is the size of the state of Connecticut, 5,000 square miles. You know, the cost of cleaning up the Great Lakes, Toledo, Ohio has had water quality issues 3-4 years running now due to agricultural runoff. Chesapeake Bay is another great example of that. I mean, it would be difficult to calculate how much.
Well, it would be difficult, but should we not make that calculation? Or do you think taxpayers should go on subsidizing the true costs of production? Which, you know, it seems to me, I'm probably crazy, that if consumers were to pay the true costs of producing food, that maybe a more efficient way of producing food might come to the fore. But as long as consumers do not have to pay for the true costs of everything, as long as those costs keep getting externalized, then taxpayers
then
pay.
There won't be a change.
Taxpayers pay.
Yeah, I mean, I get uncomfortable about this because one of the advantages of having the price of food be low is that poor people can afford it. But here you get into the problem that the relative cost of fruits and vegetables has gone up much, much higher in the last 30 years than has the index cost of junk food and sodas, for example. So that it's more expensive for people to buy fruits and vegetables because those externalized costs are borne by the producer.
Exactly. And therefore borne by the consumer.
Yeah, but Marion, also let's point out too that the fact that fresh fruits and vegetables are also difficult for people to obtain if you're in a low income community, so that compounds it as well. But I had another point there, but go ahead, Michael. I find the whole issue of how we get nutritious food into stores as opposed to junk food.
Sure, that's a whole other issue for sure.
It's another
What I'm trying to bear down here. Is the reason we have cheap food seems to be because we are very good at externalizing the true costs of food. And the reason we're so good at that is because those who have gained sufficient economies of scale can afford to buy the government and make the rules.
Yeah.
And in making those rules, they make it very cheap to produce food with the way they produce food and very expensive to produce food with the way others produce food. If you're small, if you have an acre, how do you go about influencing government?
Well, that's not even a question.
Obviously you don't.
You cannot buy the government if you have a small farm. So what happens then is those that have very
organize the movement. You know, you are part of this too, Michael, and Marion is certainly in the forefront. But you can organize a movement, and I think, and
is that
I know
what we're
Marion
doing?
Will say this. Yes, there are. I mean, the changes in the way people access food and what they know about food has changed exponentially in just the last decade, in my opinion. And Marion, I know you'll say the same thing. I mean, since Marion published Food Politics, I think, you know, we should mention that that was kind of like the real game changer for people who were interested in the food system. And Marion, you'll excuse me while I extol your virtues.
Oh, I'll just sit here quietly.
That's right. And let me talk about how great you are. But I mean, honestly, Food Politics was the book that's, and it's, I think it was revised about 2-3 years ago slightly, and updated. Isn't that right? But it came out like 14 years ago. And to me, that was the biggest eye-opener.
Well, what is the essential message of Food Politics, Marion?
How government is influenced by... Marion, you answer the question about your book.
That food policy is influenced by politics. That food is very political. I mean, it's pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm. And those who are in politics are influenced by those who have the sufficient economies of scale.
Sure. Big donors. For example, Michael, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, which is the big, cattle lobbying organization, they take their members, they take a group of their members to Washington every year for one full week, and they fan out across the halls of the Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate.
And wait a minute, we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'm going to ask you what they do in Washington, D.C. to make food cheap. Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, when we left off, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association was rounding up all kinds of cowboys and taking them to Washington, D.C. But what the heck are a bunch of cowboys going to do in Washington, D.C., Katie?
Well, what the cowboys like to do is go to Washington and lobby congressmen to support policies that support big industry, big livestock industry. So, for example, you can talk about, let's talk about food safety as a good example. So our new incoming agricultural secretary is a guy named Sonny Perdue out of Georgia, former governor. And when he was running Georgia, he rolled back the rules on food safety for the farmers in his state. Mm-hmm. And the result of that was a big peanut farming state.
Wait a minute. Which farmers did he roll back the rules for?
Well, he rolled back food safety regulations for the state of Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
He cut the funding to food safety inspection, which is something, by the way, that Trump wants to do now. And the result was something called, and this doesn't have anything to do with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, but it shows you how lobbying works. He was able to roll back these regulations because these farmers came to him and said, these regulations are making it hard for us to do business. And the result was the American Peanut Corporation, run by a guy named Stuart Parnell, mm-hmm. who's now doing 28 years in prison for poisoning people with his uninspected peanuts, which made people die. And this is an example of how a lobbying group will go into either a state or federal legislative body and say, we want X, Y, and Z. We want this regulation rolled back. Waters of the United States. This is another big fight that the agricultural community fought heavily.
Well, you know, with all due respect, we all want to be protected. And, you know, with respect to food safety, the previous administration's food safety czar was a fellow named Michael Moore, who was a former vice president of the Monsanto Corporation. So it doesn't seem to me to be a particular concern whether who's in Washington is on one side of the political spectrum or the other. It seems to me they all take the money and run. Or am I wrong?
Well, they take the money and they get rid of the regulation. Okay, let's use
or regulate. You know, regulate can also get rid of competition too. You know, it works both ways. Regulations are very good if you're the only one that can comply with the regulations.
Well, sure. And, I mean, we want and need regulations. I mean, it's not like regulations are the enemy qua the enemy. The regulations regulations that favor industry over public health, public safety, competition, et cetera, are not regulations we need. So, for example, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association will go in and lobby so that they can continue to consolidate their industry. They're lobbying against antitrust regulations. This is a big problem. We're squeezing all the competition out of the agricultural community because we have such a highly consolidated industry. Well, not only just in the meat industry, but in the corn industry, does
sure,
the same thing.
Sure. Isn't that also how industry becomes consolidated, though? Is that you send a bunch of cowboys to Washington, D.C., and you pay for the rules and regulations that make it impossible for anybody else to grow food except you. And only you have the lawyers it takes to comply with all of the regulations. And so only you can do this stuff. And that's how you get very, very... Marion, am I missing something?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, I'm greatly in favor of regulations because I think they're good for industry. They set up a level playing field and they instill consumer trust in those industries and in the government agencies that regulate them. So I've always felt that industries fighting against regulation was a really big mistake because it decreases trust in the products that they're selling.
Is there any indication that regulations can ever help small farmers grow food cheaper? Or will it always help big farmers grow food cheaper?
Well, it depends on what the regulations are. These are done politically, and if small farmers got together and had some political clout, and we had a reasonably responsive government, which we're not going to have for the next several years, but I think we need to be ready, and farmers ought to be organizing.
So that really is the only solution, isn't it? I mean, if you're a small farmer, the only way you're going to survive is to cooperate with other small farmers.
I think that's a really good idea. And that is happening. I mean, for example, New York State has the New York State Beef Cooperative. There's a lot. Rhode Island has a dairy cooperative. So does Connecticut. I think that is happening in the wake of, these smaller operators trying to compete against the very deep pockets of these highly consolidated industries like meat, like dairy, like sugar, corn, et cetera. You know, that is happening, but they need to do more. They need to get really sort of stop working in silos and work together on a federal level.
Hmm. And do I hear? Yes, I do. I hear the music already. So we have one more quick break, but I'm going to ask the most important question of all when we come back. And that is, what can we, the people, do to help give direction to our food? It seems to me like if we don't, we're going to end up paying all of the extended costs of production for food that we don't really want to eat or probably shouldn't eat. And we won't have any choice because those who have the money will go to Washington, D.C. and have their legislation and have their way with Congress, and we will be all of those costs will be foisted on to us, we the taxpayer. So what can we do? How can we take action? How can we stand up, we consumers, and be counted? This is The Food Chain, right back.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get two friends to do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too.
We can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and it will be so easy, it will make you blush. All it takes is two numbers. One is two, the other is 2-2. Join us. Take the 2x2 pledge.
There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy, it'll make you blush. Pledge two local bucks each day. Get two others to pledge and play.
Take your 2x2 pledge at metrofarm.com.
2x2. So much to say, so little time to say it. On The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, yes, so much to say. And what I have to say is that I don't think small farmers can ever organize to the extent that they will get the economies of scale they need to compete for political favors in Washington, D.C. or any state capital. Small farmers are traditionally by nature very independent and I just don't see it happening. But what I do see happening is consumers making the play. I think consumers are the ones who will lead the way. Marion, what do you think about that notion?
Well, there already are lots of organizations that are lobbying or attempting to lobby the Farm Bill in order to at least get some token $100 million, which seems like a lot but isn't in Farm Bill terms, to at least supporting the growers of fruits and vegetables. There's a new Farm Bill coming up for 2018, and now is the time that everybody should be taking a look at it. The problem with the Farm Bill is that it's so hard to understand that
it's like a scientific study, right?
Oh, no, it's much worse than a scientific study. Much, much worse. Scientific studies are understandable if you're trained. Nobody can understand the Farm Bill because it's too big.
Well, let's go quickly to Jim. Jim, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead. Fire away.
Okay, well, good. I just noticed that you happened to mention that you weren't in favor of the, if I'm not mistaken, you're not in favor of the Cattlemen's Association lobbying in Washington for, in favor of their members. However, you seem to think that the answer to, oppressive regulations is for farmers to form groups and lobby in Washington. And I'm wondering, what is the difference between the groups that you see forming to represent their rights and the Cattlemen's Association?
Well, I'll tell you exactly what I think. Thank you for the call. Really appreciate it. I think the major difference is the economies of scale. When you have the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, or like the Monsanto Corporation that has 100 trillion acres, you know, with which to contend, then you can spread the costs over so much more means of production, and those who are small can't have no way of competing, really. And that, I think, is the essential unfairness of life. And it's just always like the Tyrannosaurus Rex will always eat the deer. Maybe not.
Well, and the bigger cattle producer will happily buy up the smaller packer. I mean, and that's what's happened in the cattle industry.
And now there's
that has had big implications for farmers and ranchers. I mean, because there are so little regulation against monopolization of the industry, the consolidation of the industry has gone way past what the Sherman Act would allow, for example. I mean, this happened back at the turn of the 20th century, and Congress passed legislation so that the four big packers that were running the cattle industry then had to break down into smaller groups. Mm-hmm. And that's what we need to see today. And that's, you know, that's something that the cattle industry and all the other meat industries lobby heavily against.
And it seems like this is something that Marion is doing herself by going up against the soda industry,
mm-hmm.
and winning, and unabashedly competing and winning. Isn't that right, Marion?
I'll take full credit for it. there are large numbers of advocacy groups who are working on this all over the country.
Okay, you two are so much fun today. I want to thank both of you for joining me today. Marion Nessel and Katie Kiefer, and you. Thank you all for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't.
Thanks for having us, Michael.
Yep.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.